This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, comic Roy Wood Jr., is a correspondent for The Daily Show. He made his debut on the show the same day that Trevor Noah took over as host. Wood also hosts the Comedy Central series This Is Not Happening, in which comics tell stories about things that actually happen to them in real life. Late last year, he had a stand-up special on Comedy Central called Father Figure, in which he riffs about being black in America, being Southern, he's from Birmingham, Alabama, and being the father of a toddler. On his special, he walks up to the mic and starts like this.
But if we get rid of the Confederate flag, how am I gonna know who the dangerous white people are? I'm just saying, the flag had a couple upsides, so let's just be real about it. I ain't saying keep it around, but I grew up in the South. I can't tell you how many times the Confederate flag came in handy. You stopping for gas at a strange place at 2 a.m, you see that flag hanging from the window, you know this is not the place to get gas. And you keep it moving. What's the rush to get rid of the flag? Especially if you're white. If you're white, you should want to keep the flag for a little while longer so at least black folks will know you cool. Because if you're white and you're not an ass, that's the one thing that helps us identify you. You get rid of that flag, we'll be, We got to figure out a way to know who the cool white people. Cool white people, we just got to start giving y'all wristbands or hand stamps. Just something you can show in a dark alley. Let us know you down with the struggle. That'd be cool. Give me your money, white dude. Like, whoa, I'm so sorry. Come on through. Come on through. No, they got the wristbands. They good. Listen, put this wristband on. Just want to win out. In case it go down, I'm going to have that wristband on.
Roy Wood Jr., welcome to Fresh Air. So the bit we just heard, it kind of starts in the middle of a sentence. It starts with but, but it's the opening line of your comedy special. Why did you start in the middle of a thought like that? Because we all know where you're going.
I feel like once you hear the word Confederate flag, I've got your undivided attention.
True.
And the first sentence of the special is, but if we get rid of the Confederate flag, which to me already positions me in an unpopular place of attempting to defend the flag, I just felt like that would be a more gripping way to start a comedy special versus the traditional, hey, how you doing, which I eventually got to it on the back end of that bit. But it was just something that kind of happened in happenstance where the way that the bit wasn't originally done that way. It was done in a traditional, now let's talk about the Confederate flag. But I'd been in an argument with a comedian off to the side of the stage as I was being introduced, and I basically walked the argument onto the stage as if I was continuing a conversation when in actuality I really was.
A national conversation, yes.
Yeah, an actual conversation.
And a conversation between you and the other comic.
That
yes.
First line, as originally performed, was to a comedian standing off to the side of the stage.
That's
I
great.
Wasn't even acknowledging the crowd. And it got a laugh, and I go, oh, maybe that's the first bit that I should walk on stage from now on, because it instantly puts the audience in their seats. And, you know, for me, I'm very anxious to get to the jokes. I'm not big on salutations. I'm not a crowd work guy. And it's not that I don't appreciate the audience. I do. But I'm just a performer that's anxious to get to his craft. I kind of liken it to how the musicians, like when you go see a rock concert and the band comes out and they don't say hello and they rock out for 10 minutes. And then at the conclusion of that 10 minutes, they go, Detroit, how you doing tonight? And it's like, whoa.
So that bit sounds like it has a lot of truth behind it. Did you feel when you were growing up in Alabama like Confederate flags warned you away from places and people that spell trouble?
Yeah, I think the difference between Southern racism and Northern racism is that in the South, you know where you stand. And there's, I don't want to say a freedom in that, but when you know where the boundaries are, then you kind of know how to play the game a little bit more. So if someone's going to openly say, I don't like you people, and I'm going to hang a flag over my door to remind you I don't like you people, then I know not to eat at that business. How much cleaner is that than me sitting there and getting bad service for an hour and a half, complaining to the manager, and nothing happening. Mm-hmm. Which one is more tormenting? The Confederate flag is literally more convenient. You save me 90 minutes.
Did you see a lot of Confederate flags growing up in Alabama?
Yeah, but I also started as a comedian. My first 9 years of comedy, from 98 until I moved to Los Angeles, you know, I was a Southern and Midwest act. So, you know, I did a lot of shows in a lot of strange places, a lot of armpits of America, if you will. Beautiful places, sometimes questionable people. So I've seen Confederate flags, and I don't want to say it doesn't bother me because, you know, it's troubling to think why someone has the flag, you know, but it doesn't scare me in that sense.
You say you performed at strange places. Did you ever perform at a bar or a club that had a Confederate flag?
Absolutely. I've been called the N-word from the stage by somebody in the crowd, and the club owner did nothing to defend me. So there's definitely been questionable situations, but at the end of the day, give me my $50 that I drove 9 hours to get paid so I can be on my way back to Birmingham. Cities like that, traditionally, my protocol was to never stay at the hotel that the venue provided. So I'd either sleep in my car or I would stay at I would drive 3 or 4 hours out of town. Like, I would split the drive that night and just drive halfway back to Birmingham and then sleep somewhere else, because I just felt like in those towns, if I'm one of the few black people and I'm here telling the jokes and, you know, ha, 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 it's all fun and games. But to some people there, it isn't a game. You know, there's a level of respect you have to have for someone who's bold enough to say that they don't like you and that they'll call you one of the most hated words in the history of this country. Somebody like that might be motivated to come find you after the show. And I'm the only person in town with Alabama plate, so yeah, get the hell out of there. And, you know, thankfully every gig wasn't like that, but I'm thankful for those gigs. So, you know, it's, if nothing more, my first 9-10 years of comedy were just a very, very bitter education on the psyche of the middle of the country.
Why were you even booked in places that had such a kind of racist audience?
Because they had a microphone. I didn't care. Why should I care?
Did they know that you were African-American when they booked you?
Yeah, but they figure black people are funny, but you just better not date my daughter or hang around town too late. Like, I did a show in Johnson City, Tennessee, which is a eastern Tennessee mountain town, and people would come up after the show, and there's some neighboring town over, and supposedly there's a sign that says, "Don't let the sun set on your black ass here in this town," where you basically had sundown warnings where you had to leave by the time lights were out. And this is 2002, 2003. This is recent. So when you're booked in a weird city and the booker calls you and goes, "Hey, man, I need you to go do blah, 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 Arkansas," and you look at it on a map and you can see that it's, I call it the blue lines, the freeway. You know, the freeways on, like, the atlases are blue. They're denoted by the color blue. So I could look and tell by how far off the blue line a city was whether or not I was going to have problems. And it looks like a problem city. Okay, I'm going to go into town late. I'm going to pull up right to the venue. I'm going to do my gig, get my money, and then I'm leaving.
Now, you say at the end of your stand-up comedy special that, you know, right now you only want to do humor that has some kind of, like, social significance, that has some kind of, like, larger meaning. Is that something relatively new for you in terms of, you know, not just, like, telling jokes, but have it, like, really mean something?
Yeah, I think stylistically, I think The Daily Show really did change my perspective on humor with regards to, number one, trying to understand the other side of the issue, and then number two, digging a little deeper than the surface on the topic at hand to find, you know, nuggets of wisdom that are a little bit more truthful and explanatory. And, you know, I don't think my comedy wasn't always like that. You know, I started at 19, so my perspective was lacking for, I'd argue, the first 8 to 10 years, just because I was a young man in his 20s still sorting out life. And, you know, the best comedy is delivered by people that have been through some stuff and experienced some things and seen the world. And I just hadn't done enough yet. Whereas you get a little older, you delve into the world some, you have your heart broken a couple times, you break a few hearts, you have a child, you got a little bit of a body of work to draw on at that point, you know? And I think that for me, once I started The Daily Show, it really started changing the trajectory of my comedy.
Well, let's hear an example of you on The Daily Show. And this is really funny. This is from April 29th, 2016. And you're doing, basically you're doing a rap video as if you were Donald Trump. And all of the phrases in this are things that Donald Trump has
every
actually
single lyric.
Said. Yes.
Yeah.
And so, okay, so let's hear it.
I have a great relationship with the blacks.
The blacks.
Politicians all talking to action. I was down at 7-Eleven. I spent almost nothing on my run for president. All the women flirted with me on The Apprentice. If Ivanka were my daughter, then perhaps I'd be dating her. We have to have a wall done. Who's doing the raping? We have to have a wall done. Who's doing the raping? Check me out, Democrats, they love me.
Woo!
Check me out, these Muslims love me.
Oh, yeah.
Stop hating these women, love
they
me.
Love
these gays
me.
Love me. Everybody love me.
Told you.
Check me out, Megyn Kelly, she love
me.
Check me out, illegals, they love me.
Love
what it do, these veterans love me. Protesters love me. Everybody love me.
Told ya.
I'm so good looking. I'm really rich. Part of the beauty of me is that I'm very rich. Don't respect women. They know it's the opposite. Ariana Huffington is unattractive. Happy Easter to all. I never seen a thin person drinking Diet Coke.
That is hilarious.
That came from...
Yeah, tell us the story.
You know, we were just talking about how much Trump brags. And it was just more of a, you know, like he literally is like a rapper. He talks about his house, his boat, his properties. And I started talking with Jordan Klepper, who was a correspondent at the time. And this is before he was hosting Opposition. And Klepper and I were like, I bet if we dug deep enough into his tweets, we could find enough bars to put into stanzas to make a full-blown rap song. And that's what we did. And we combed through the Microsoft Word document was font size 12, single-spaced, and it was about 20 pages of just quotes and tweets and just anything braggadocious. And we just neatly went through and just found line by line and just put it all together.
And I love that the chorus was, they love me, everybody loves me. They all love me. Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun. And, you know, and that's, it's one thing to say, you know, back to the original point of digging deeper, we could easily make the analogy of, hey, here is Trump bragging about this, this, and this. He's a rapper. Ha, ha, ha. And you move on to the next joke in Trevor's monologue or my desk chat or whatever. But the next level is to actually, if he's a rapper, let's prove it. Let's do a whole rap song. Let's go in a studio. Let's listen to beats for 3 hours and figure out which beat matches these tweets. And let's rent one of these Bruce Wayne manors out. The video is still up on YouTube as far as I know.
It is.
But there's Ferraris. We hired models. We had a golf course. We went way beyond what could have just been a three-line joke if we just wanted it to be that.
Do you have any idea if Donald Trump saw the video?
Oh, they saw it. I guarantee you they saw it. We had a researcher that sent off for press credentials for a Trump rally at the time the election was still going on. And they didn't reply to the email. So our researcher hits him up again and goes, hey, it's The Daily Show. Can we get credentialed for the Trump rally? And their reply was the YouTube link to the Trump video.
Wow. Okay. They definitely saw it.
No other words, nothing else. The only thing they replied with was the link to the video.
So you and Trevor Noah started on the same day at The Daily Show. Who discovered you? Was it Trevor Noah or Jon Stewart?
It was Trevor. It was Trevor and his people. You know, at the time before Daily Show, I had been doing, I'd come off of a sitcom on TBS, Sullivan and Son. We had gotten canceled. And so for that following year, I was doing most of my television appearances were guest roles on ESPN, on the, you know, various shows on their family of networks. So a lot of what you do on ESPN as a comedian isn't that different from The Daily Show. You take the day's news and you find the punchlines. And it's even more difficult at ESPN because you can't offend sponsors and athletes and teams. And there's more potholes in comedic humor with sports versus politics. Politics, it's all in the game. You can go after anybody, but it's a much more manicured, delicate way of making jokes in the sports realm. And I guess I did well enough from that to catch somebody's eye over on Trevor's side. And I got the call for the audition. And 6 days later, I was in New York City. That's the other thing they don't tell you about The Daily Show, is that when you're hired, it's like, yeah, you start now. Like, what? My stuff's in California. Yeah, that's cool. They hire people, but you start now. We need you now.
So I want to play another clip from your comedy special, Father Figure. And in this, you know, you're talking about how we live in two different Americas, and that when white people don't understand what African-Americans experience, it doesn't necessarily mean that the white people are racist. Sometimes it's just that the white people are uninformed. And then as an example, you talk about going to a Best Buy where you had to educate a white sales clerk. You had just bought a cell phone case, and the
Correct.
Sales clerk told you that you didn't need a bag for it. So you had to explain why you needed the bag.
Dude at Best Buy gonna decide I don't need a bag with my purchase. You just have an iPhone case. I figure you could just pop that open. No, I ain't popping. You put it in the bag. I need that in a bag. What do you need a bag for? I understand why you need a bag. It's wasteful, recycle. Don't you care about the earth? I go, sir, this has nothing to do with the earth. I'm a black man in America. I gotta leave this store with a bag, bruh. It's about safety. I'm black. I don't get the luxury of just walking out with in my hand. That is a roll of the dice. That is a horrifying day. If I would know, not only do I need that bag, bitch, I need that receipt and staple it to the outside. I don't want a receipt in my hand. You staple my receipt to the outside like Chinese carryout, and I hold it up in the air. I Lion King, I Hakuna Matata, an iPhone case out of Best Buy. And it's not his fault. He just didn't understand. He thought he was saving the earth, but he was saving a life. That's what he was doing.
That's my guest, Roy Wood Jr., on his recent comedy special, Father Figure. So is that a true story? Did that really happen?
Yeah, that happened in Seattle. And it wasn't as flagrant as I made the sales clerk out to be in the joke, but it was me very politely explaining to this guy, I don't want to walk out of here without a bag. I just don't. Like, you're cool, but the yellow shirt up there at the door, he doesn't know, or he's not going to assume. I have no bag, no receipt. I'm just walking out with something in my hand. That concept is so foreign to me as a minority, and having been harassed and followed around stores before and suspected of shoplifting, why would I give someone invitation to question whether or not I'm operating within the boundaries of the law?
I thought it was so interesting that you chose somebody to tell a story about who perceives himself as doing the right thing, as being very environmental-minded and therefore trying to not give you a plastic bag, but not getting what it would mean for you to walk out without the bag and the receipt.
Yeah, and
I mean, you'd have
regard,
the receipt, but it would probably be in your pocket, and then if you reach for it, who knows how that would be interpreted.
Yeah, it's just, nah, it's just, if I don't care if I bought a Tic Tac. I want a bag. I want the biggest bag you have just to make sure. And, you know, and that's where, when it comes to educating people about issues of race, and just here's a snippet of black life you might not have considered, something as simple about a bag. Like, for me, I enjoy being able to find material that's specific in that regard, because it gives me an opportunity to just show a little bit more of my world and what I believe African Americans go through. And it's not to vilify this man, because I can't say that he's racist because he didn't know that a bag could get me harassed. If he doesn't have a black friend that's ever explained that to him, when was he ever going to learn it? here's a joke for me to explain it to all of y'all.
So you're a father now. You have a son who's a toddler?
Correct.
How does your approach to parenting compare to how you were parented?
I try to be present more. That's the toughest part. I now struggle with what my mother struggled with. How do you provide but be present? And that's a very difficult thing for any parent to manage.
And you're on the road a lot.
Yeah. You know, 2 weeks a month I'm on the road. And, you know, for now, you know, my son and my partner, you know, they'll travel with me. And when the logistics are appropriate, my son will travel with me. But I often feel like I have to work harder now. This is going to sound horrible, but I hope this makes sense. For me, these years don't matter as much as the ones to come. And those are the ones that, like, if I had to pick a 10-year stretch to be present for my son, physically present and there, I would pick 10 to 20 versus 1 to 10.
Why is that?
Because 10 to 20 is where you really get an opportunity to shape and really infuse the morality. You lay the groundwork that first decade, but that second decade, it's for me, and raising a black man in this society, a six-year-old can't understand the conversations that I need to have with him about consent and about how to deal with the police and about how to make sure he gets a bag when he leaves that store. A 13-year-old can. And those are the lessons that will maybe save his life. So if I have to be gone an extra weekend to make enough money so that I don't have to work later on, or that I can work smarter later on, then I'm going to be gone. And, you know, my mom spent a greater part of most of my school years in some degree of night school. Not contiguously, but, you know, I distinctly remember my mom, when we were in Memphis, she went over to Memphis State and got her master's. When we got to Birmingham, she was in law school for four and a half years at night. So my mom would come home at 5, check homework till 6, and she was right back out the door. By the time she got home at 9:30 or 10, she was asleep. There was a 4-year stretch where I saw my mom probably cumulatively 45 minutes a day. But that's because she was out trying to build to make a better existence for me.
It's really been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Roy Wood Jr. is a correspondent on The Daily Show, and he hosts the Comedy Central series This Is Not Happening. His recent Comedy Central stand-up special is called Father Figure. After tackling the story of the Pentagon Papers in The Post, Steven Spielberg returns to his escapist roots with Ready Player One, a sci-fi action-adventure movie adapted from a novel by Ernest Cline. The movie features Ben Mendelsohn, Mark Rylance, and Lena Waithe. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
It's the year 2045, and Columbus, Ohio has become an overpopulated junk heap of a city. The colors are gray and muted. People dwell in cramped trailers stacked on top of each other in rickety towers. But dystopia isn't all doom and gloom. When Dorothy got tired of Kansas, she flew over the rainbow. And in Ready Player One, Steven Spielberg's fantastical but fatally overblown juggernaut of a movie, anyone can strap on virtual reality goggles and achieve the ultimate escape. Our guide to this brave new world is Wade Watts, a young orphan, played by Ty Sheridan, who lives with his aunt in Columbus.
My name's Wade Watts. My dad picked that name because it sounded like a superhero's alter ego, like Peter Parker or Bruce Banner. But he died when I was a kid, my mom too. And I ended up here, sitting here in my tiny corner of nowhere. There's nowhere left to go. Nowhere. Except the Oasis.
Imagine if someone had taken the eye-popping worlds within worlds of Inception, The Matrix, and last year's Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets, then smashed them together into a giant CGI mega mall, and you'll have some idea of how this astoundingly elaborate virtual reality universe operates. The Oasis was the brainchild of the late tech visionary James Holliday, who, as played by Mark Rylance in flashbacks, comes off as a nicer, nerdier Steve Jobs. Along with his old friend Ogden Morrow, played by Simon Pegg, Holiday dreamed up a fully immersive world where visitors could create their own digital avatars, lose themselves in interactive games, and shop online to their heart's content. Before his death, Holiday left behind a Willy Wonka-style competition to find his heir, the person who would safeguard his legacy. Hidden throughout the Oasis are three keys, unlocking a series of clues that will lead one lucky player to the carefully hidden grand prize, the ultimate Easter egg, the rights to the Oasis itself. The twisty plot requires Wade to solve puzzles and join forces with a smart, tough-as-nails love interest named Artemis, played by Olivia Cooke, plus a few other trusty allies played by Lena Waithe, Wynn Morisaki, and Philip Zhao. Their arch-nemesis, played with a testy scowl by Ben Mendelsohn, is Nolan Sorrento, a former Holiday intern who now runs a soulless, murderous conglomerate bent on finding the keys at any cost. Holiday also designed the Oasis with another purpose: to pay homage to every movie, TV show, video game, and comic book he ever consumed. Like the popular 2011 Ernest Cline science fiction novel on which it's based, Ready Player One is an extended Valentine to those pop culture relics, most of which came out in the 80s, and are thus beloved by people who grew up watching, well, Steven Spielberg movies. Spielberg avoids any allusions to his own films, apart from a stray dinosaur who may or may not hail from Jurassic Park. But as one of the undisputed high priests of American popular entertainment, he is in many ways enshrining his own legacy. Frankly, I wish he'd been more careful with it. At nearly 2.5 hours, Ready Player One is an awful lot of movie. Watching it is like taking the world's most expensive, hallucinatory nostalgia trip. The pop culture references fly so thick and fast, they make Quentin Tarantino look restrained. A tire-screeching car race includes a highly destructive cameo by King Kong. There are appearances by Batman, The Goonies, and The Iron Giant, the star of a wonderful underseen 1999 animated feature that maybe some fraction of this movie's audience will feel compelled to check out. I won't give away the title of the film that inspires Spielberg's most exhaustively detailed homage. Suffice it to say that the resulting sequence is both spectacular and spectacularly empty, the apotheosis of this movie's dazzling but self-defeating aesthetic. There's no denying that Ready Player One is a triumph of computer-generated imagery. The colors are wild, the avatars are engaging, and every new dimension we enter has 100 different details to tickle the eye. But it's also a failure of dramatic engagement, and, especially in its second half, a busy, protracted slog. Spielberg can barely sit still long enough to grapple with the political implications of his futuristic premise, and his sensibility is too sanitized to explore the darker, more provocative aspects of 24/7 online addiction. None of the script's lame wisecracks made me roll my eyes as hard as the ending, with its half-hearted message that we all need to disconnect from our gadgets and connect with each other. Now there's an idea. The best thing in the movie, as in a few other Spielberg movies of late, is Mark Rylance, whose solemn, spaced-out line readings are pure pleasure to listen to. Holiday, a populist uber-geek with a touchingly pure soul, may be the benevolent overlord of Ready Player One. But it takes its cues from Nolan Sorrento, who started out fetching Holiday's coffee, and who now happily exploits fan culture for the sake of his own profits. He more or less sums up this movie's crass, cynical spirit.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. Coming up, we talk with Sara Saidi about when she was a teenage girl worried about pimples, boys, and being deported. She was 2 years old when her family fled Iran and came to California in 1982. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest says her life began during a hostage crisis, a revolution, and a war. When Sara Saidi was born in Iran in 1980, Americans were being held hostage by revolutionary Iranian students who had stormed the American embassy. The Ayatollah Khomeini had just come to power, turning the country into a fundamentalist state, and Iran was at war with Iraq. When Saidi was 2, she fled the country with her family and moved to California, where they had relatives. When their visitors' visas expired, they stayed in California, hoping their applications for green cards would eventually be approved. Saidi remembers her teenage years as marked by aloof boys, prepping for the SATs, and a looming fear of deportation. She became a citizen at the age of 26. She's now a TV writer. She's currently with the CW series iZombie, and she writes books for young adults. Her new book is a memoir for young adults called Americanized, Rebel Without a Green Card. Sarah Saidi, welcome to Fresh Air. So were you the only person your age when you were growing up who you knew who was also undocumented?
Yes, aside from my sister, who was 3 years older than me, I didn't know anybody else in my friend group or in my high school that was undocumented.
So you were 13 when you found out your family's immigration status.
Yes.
Tell us a story of how you found out.
Well, you know, I had no idea that we were undocumented. I'd never even heard the term. At that time, they said illegal alien. And I had never heard that term before. It was just one afternoon after school, spending time with my sister, and she was filling out job applications. And I remember her being really frustrated because every application asked for a social security number. And I didn't even know at the time what a social security number was. And she revealed to me that we didn't have social security numbers because we had entered the country illegally, and that we could essentially get deported at any point if the government found out that we were living in the United States.
So how did that knowledge affect you?
It was shocking. I mean, at that point, we had been living in the U.S., in the Bay Area specifically, for 10 years. And it gave me a lot of anxiety as a teenager, just the idea that we could get deported, that we could get sent back to Iran, which was a country that I was familiar with because we were Iranian, but never, I didn't remember living there. I was 2 years old when I came to the States. So I would say that it gave me a baseline of anxiety through my teen years, all the way until I was 20, which is when I finally did get a green card.
How worried were you about getting deported when you were a teenager?
It was something that was always in the back of my mind. My parents were very reassuring, and they tried to tell us that something like that would never happen. But we were very aware of the fact that it was a possibility. Our application to get a green card was actually pending at that point. So I found out later as I was researching the book that we would have only gotten deported if our application was denied. But during the process of waiting, we were sort of in a safe period.
So you're very funny about this in the book, although it's really not funny. At the same time that you were dealing with fear of deportation, you were also dealing with bad acne. So did the fears of getting deported make the acne seem any less significant?
Probably not. According to my high school journals and diaries, the acne probably came up more consistently than being an undocumented immigrant did. So, yeah, there was still a lot of that typical teen angst that I was dealing with growing up. I think that being undocumented was just another part of it that most teenagers weren't dealing with. And it was actually something that I unfortunately couldn't vent about to most of my friends because it was something that we wanted to keep secret.
Right. So the deportation fee were something you had to keep secret, whereas the acne, you could not keep secret at all.
Yes, exactly. It was right
very,
on my
very
face.
Visible. Yes. So it's just such an interesting dichotomy. You know, on the one hand, you're living this kind of like suburban life in the Bay Area. You're going to a good school, in part because you lied about your address. You gave a relative's address so that you could get into a better school. When I say you, I mean your parents.
Yes, we were very resourceful in that way.
Yes. So at the same time, like you're living this like nice suburban existence, going to this great school, you're also in some ways having to stay in the shadows and be a little secretive.
Yeah, I think the big difference, you know, as I was researching the book and writing about my family's story, the big difference between being undocumented when I was in the 90s versus now is that, you know, first of all, there was no social media then. There was hardly any internet. So there wasn't the sense of community that I think that many undocumented immigrants luckily have today, whether it's, you know, kids that are in the DACA program that are activists or tweeting about the fact that they're undocumented and the struggles that come along with it. I didn't have that growing up, so it felt very isolating in a lot of ways. There was a couple of close friends that knew that my family was undocumented. I actually had a really close friend that lived in Seattle. And one summer when I went to visit her, her parents wanted to take us to Vancouver, and they had to ask my mom to make sure that I packed my passport. And my mom had to explain to them at that point that they couldn't take me to Vancouver because I didn't have a green card and I couldn't leave the country. So there was some people that were very close to us that knew the fact that we were undocumented, but it certainly wasn't something that I talked about day to day with my friends.
Your father had gone to college at Louisiana State University, so he lived in the States for a few years, and then he married your mother while he was still a student, so she lived here with him for a couple of years. Then they returned to Iran. Why did they decide to flee the country, and when was it?
They decided to leave Iran in 1982, so it was a couple years after the revolution, and they just saw the country go through a very extreme shift in a very short amount of time. During the protests against the Shah, my parents were very much supportive of the Shah being removed from the country at that point. They just didn't realize that, from their perspective, the country was going to change for the worse. And once the Ayatollah Khomeini came into power, and my family was mostly secular, so they just struggled a lot with many of the changes, including like when my mother, for instance, grew up in Iran, she didn't have to wear a chador, she didn't have to cover her hair. So
no, you say she wore miniskirts.
She did, yeah, she did. I've seen the photos. So Iran during the 70s, I mean, not many people know this, but it was, you know, it was a vacation destination for many Westerners. It was a thriving city, Tehran, where I was born. And yeah, it had a lot of European sensibilities. And so to watch the country change in the way that it did, it was very shocking for many of my family members, and it was very unexpected at that point. So in 1982, I was 2 years old at the time. My sister was 5 years old, and the country was also at war with Iraq. And that was an interesting time because the United States actually supported Iraq in that war. The borders were closed in Iran, and my dad was able to bribe somebody in the government to get us papers for my mom, my sister, and I to leave the country. So they decided to move to the United States because my uncle was already living in the Bay Area at the time, and also because they had lived there for a period of time when my father was in college. But I don't think that they thought this was a permanent move. I think they believed that we're going to wait it out, we'll go to the U.S. for a few years, and eventually we'll probably end up back in Iran. But, you know, a few years went by and it became very clear that the country wasn't ever going to be the way that it was when they lived there.
When your family left Iran, they had to do it in stages. Your mother went with you and your older sister, and your father had to stay behind. Why did he have to stay behind?
One of the reasons that he stayed behind is because they didn't think that the government would allow us to leave the country if my dad was coming with us. What my mom had told the government was that my uncle was ill in California and that she wanted to be able to see him. It wasn't true. My uncle was actually very healthy at the time. And my dad ended up staying behind because it would seem obvious if we were all leaving together that we were actually going to leave the country permanently. But if it was just my mom and my sister and I and my dad stayed, then they would think that she was planning on returning.
So, you know, you write when your father joined your family after 3 months, you didn't recognize him and you were afraid of him for a while. And that must have just broken his heart.
Yeah, he says, looking back on that time, that that was the most difficult part of our separation because I was only 2 years old, so I didn't have much memory of him. And it was hard for me to adjust being around this person that I had been away from for a few months, who was essentially a stranger to me at that point.
So I don't want to get too deep into the bureaucracy of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, but can you just give us an overview of what your status was and how it changed over time?
Of course. Yeah, one of my goals in writing this book is that I wanted people to understand how complicated and lengthy the process of becoming naturalized can be. So we entered the country in 1982 on a U.S. visitor's visa, and we overstayed our visa once it expired. We then applied for political asylum, which basically would mean that we wouldn't be able to return to Iran, because when you're applying for political asylum, you're essentially saying that your life is in danger if you return to your home country. And after a couple years, we checked on the status of our application and were told that there was no record of it. So to this day, we don't know what happened. It somehow got lost in the shuffle. At that point, our only option was to apply to get a green card through my uncle, my mom's brother, who was an American citizen. And so he sponsored us, and we didn't end up getting our green card through that application until the year 2000. So it was 18 years since we moved to the country. I think it was 14 years since we applied to get a green card through him. So it was a very long wait period. Along the way, there was other things that my parents attempted to do. Once they saw that that application was taking such a long time, my grandmother on my mom's side was a green card holder. So we decided to apply to get a green card through her to see if that would be any faster. One of the things that my parents were told by a lawyer, though, was that you can't apply to get a green card through your parent if you're married. So my parents ended up getting a divorce so that my mom would be able to apply to get a green card through her mother and hopefully get green cards for my sister and I. When my grandmother passed away, that application became null and void. And so my parents essentially remarried, and we ended up getting the green card through my uncle. It just took an extremely long time.
Must have been pretty crazy in your family when your parents divorced in order to get the green card.
Yeah, it was really tough because, you know, I write a lot in the book about my parents' relationship, and I was very lucky that I was raised by two people that were happily married. So the fact that they had to get a divorce to speed up our process of getting green cards was a hard pill for me to swallow because I felt like they had worked really hard on their marriage and they were very happy together. And even though it was just a divorce on paper, it still didn't feel right to me that people would have to go to such great lengths to be able to live in the country.
So tell us about the day that you became an American citizen. What was the ceremony like for you?
So I became a citizen in 2006. Once you get a green card, you have to wait. I believe it's a 5 or 6 year period of time that you have to wait in order to become a citizen. The ceremony, I'll admit, it was a bit anticlimactic. I had a lot of people around me who were very excited for me. I had coworkers and family friends and my boyfriend's family who were very congratulatory. And I had really mixed feelings about it. I mean, I was very happy that our immigration struggle was finally coming to an end. I was excited to finally get to vote in an election. But it felt bittersweet because in some ways it did feel like a betrayal to the Iranian side of me. I didn't know how happy I should be about it. And the ceremony itself, I kind of treated it like going to the DMV to get a driver's license. And looking back on it, I'm really regretful of that. I wish that I had more gratitude for finally becoming a citizen. I wish that I soaked in that moment a little bit more. But I was a busy TV executive at the time, and I remember bringing a script with me to the ceremony and thumbing through it as they were swearing us in. So maybe that was the most American thing I could be doing, was to be working while becoming an American citizen. I think that maybe at that point I was a little bit cynical about the process. I think I was a little bit bitter about what we had been put through in order to become citizens. So maybe that prevented me from embracing it fully. I think politically, too, I was struggling a lot with some of the things that were going on in the country. And so, quite honestly, it was hard to sit through a video of George W. Bush welcoming me to the United States because I had mixed feelings about that administration. So there was a lot of other things that came into play that made me struggle with the process. But I think looking back on it, it was such a relief, and it had been such a long and arduous process that it was nice to put that in the past. And I was also really excited to get to vote in an election because I hadn't been able to vote in 2000 and I hadn't been able to vote in 2004. So to be able to finally vote in the next election was a really, really big deal for me. And I will say to this day, I vote in every election and I never, ever take it for granted.
So you voted in 3 presidential elections. Obama won the first 2, Trump won the 3rd. Considering Donald Trump's anti-immigration policies and his anti-immigration positions as a candidate, how did his election affect you and how has his presidency affected you? Has it had an effect on your day-to-day life?
It's had a huge impact. One of the things that motivated me to write the book was the rhetoric that seemed so hostile towards immigrants during the 2016 election. And so as I was writing the book, at that point, I'll be honest, like many people, I assumed that Hillary Clinton was going to win the election. So it definitely shifted the tone of the book once Donald Trump was elected. And I think day to day, it's anytime you turn on the news, you hear about the border wall, you hear a lot of negative descriptions of immigrants and undocumented immigrants, which were so opposite my experience. So that was actually a great motivator in writing the book and hoping that people would read it and realize that many of the things that we're being told about undocumented immigrants are actually really inaccurate. And in some ways, I think it would have been much more challenging. Well, in many ways, it would have been much more challenging to go through the process of being undocumented while having a president in office who is not very sympathetic towards immigrants at all. So I'm grateful for my status today, but I will say that once you become a citizen, after going through the process of being undocumented, that anxiety never really leaves you. There is part of you that still always feels like they might find a way to kick me out of this country. And with the current administration that we have, I'll admit that I do have that anxiety, especially in writing the book and being so candid about the fact that I was undocumented for so long. There's still that part of you that feels like maybe there's a loophole, maybe there's a way that they're still going to kick me out of this country. And I don't know, nothing would surprise me these days.
Okay, well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Sarah Saidi's new memoir for young adults is called Americanized: Rebel Without a Green Card.